1962, I joined the Navy, went down there to San Diego, and we were there for probably about a week while we were getting our company formed, getting our uniforms and things like that. When one morning we were standing in formation, and our drill instructor started asking everybody where we were from. Went through and we told them, everybody told them where we were from, and I come up and he said from Sheridan County in Montana, and stopped a little bit and hesitated, and all of a sudden he asked me, he said, "Are you a communist?" And I had no clue what he was talking about, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you, son," he said, "the only place there was ever a communist funeral was in Sheridan County, Montana." And he said, "I just want to know if you're a communist." It was the first time in my life where I'd ever heard anything about it.
Welcome to Talking History. I'm Jerry Zahavi, and with me today, it's my pleasure to have Verlaine Stoner McDonald, a professor in the Department of English, Theater, and Speech Communication at Berea College in Kentucky. She grew up in Sheridan County in a farm homesteaded by her great-grandparents, and she is also the author of The Red Corner, The Rise and Fall of Communism in Northeastern Montana, a book I wish I had written, but she beat me to it. It's a wonderful study of the story of the rise and fall of communism in Sheridan County, Montana. Welcome to Talking History.
Thank you, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, why don't we start in the beginning? How did you ever get interested in writing about communism in Montana, and specifically in northeastern Montana?
Well, I was born and raised in Sheridan County, Montana, and was educated there, kindergarten through 12th grade. Although I graduated from Plentywood High School and had even taken a Montana history course, I had never heard about a radical period in our history when our county had a communist element, a very successful communist group. I found out about this in 1985 when Bill Wirtz, who worked for my parents and still does, found copies of communist newspapers in a trunk hidden away in an old building on the farm. They were published in Plentywood, Montana, and that was the first that I heard about this period in our history.
You know, most people listening to us, since this is nationally syndicated, probably don't even know what it's like up here in northeastern Montana. So maybe before we get into the whole story of communism and the left in this region, we should give them a sense of what it looks like. So maybe you, being a native of this region, maybe you can fill them in on that.
Sure. I think most people, when they think about Montana, have images perhaps from television or movies, films like A River Runs Through It, of the mountainous western part of the state. But where I grew up, it is, of course, as you said, northeastern Montana, and it's prairies, very few trees, tall grass and rolling hills, very dry. There were Native Americans, Assiniboine Native American tribes. White people first came to this area in the late 19th century. At that time, of course, there would have been buffalo. But it's sparsely populated today, even more so than it was in the teens and 20s. Winters are tough, very cold. It's often very windblown, and the summers can be quite dry as well. Grasshoppers are often a problem, or have been in the past. So it was a sparse, rather challenging place for a lot of the homesteaders who came from more lush settings in the Midwest and especially Scandinavia.
Occasionally, in traveling through the county, I noted the various bluffs and coulees that cut through the county. So it's not entirely rolling hills. And there are a whole bunch of stories that people have been telling me, and you undoubtedly. You've been familiar with a lot of the outlaw stories in this area, that they use some of the coulees to make their way back and forth from Canada down here.
It's true. As you say, the terrain actually is quite diverse, and those sandstone bluffs and coulees are cavernous. It's true that there were cattle rustlers, outlaws, and this also provided cover for those who wanted to do a little rum running over the border from Canada. Saskatchewan is just, you know, borders on the north of Sheridan County. And so there is a wildness to the landscape today. And definitely it was popular with some of those who wanted to skirt the law in the past.
You know, in looking at the history of this region, I'm struck by the long history of farmer activism that goes back well into the 19th century before it was really settled. You know, I'm talking about the region being North Dakota and Saskatchewan and eastern Montana in general, that there were all sorts of groups that were active and were trying to help farmers. Can you say something about those groups?
Sure. I think that this kind of concern arose, as you said, early in the night, or at least in the mid-19th century, with organizations like the Grange rising up to try to give a voice to farmers, to try to address some of their concerns. And, of course, the Farmers Alliance and the populist movement. There's a history, you know, dating quite a ways back and stretching from Texas up to the Midwest that I see as precursors to the kind of activism you see in northeastern Montana in the teens and 20s.
And then you've got the Debsian socialism coming in, and then in the early decades of the 20th, well, in the first decade of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And so one of the men who would really become, I view him as the leader of the communist organization in Sheridan County, even as a child, was a great supporter of Eugene Debs and dedicated to that sort of ideology. His father, his name was Charlie Taylor. His father had been a greenbacker, and so I think many of them drew their inspiration from some of those earlier organizations that sought to help farmers and workers.
And then you have the emergence of the Nonpartisan League in the mid-teens out of North Dakota.
That's right, founded by a man named Arthur Townley, who was apparently really a magnetic personality. The NPL was not a third party, but instead it sought any candidate, Democrat, Republican, who would stand for the farmers. The NPL would endorse that person and run on the ballot, and they had tremendous success with that tactic, moved into Montana, and it was actually the NPL that sent Charlie Taylor to northeastern Montana in 1918.
So let's get into that. I mean, Charles Taylor becomes a very significant personality in the movement in the next decade plus. How did he ever get involved with the NPL, and how was he specifically sent?
He described himself as a dues-paying member of the Socialist Party in the teens, and was very active in that cause. He'd been a homesteader in Minnesota and Wyoming, a newspaper man, a teacher. As he watched the progress of the NPL, he became convinced that that was at least one way to create progress in serving the needs of farmers and workers. He walked into their offices in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, offered his services, and I think they probably recognized his potential and sent him out to Plentywood, where there was already this nucleus of socialists. And he did very quickly create a following here in northeastern Montana.
So we've got socialist parties active here. We have the Nonpartisan League coming in, Charlie Taylor coming in 1918.
Yes.
To take over the paper. At the same time, a year earlier, 1917, we have the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, how does Bolshevism come to Sheridan County?
Right. I think it comes in the form of some of those folks who would emerge as leaders, Charlie, I think, being one of them, but also his comrade, Rodney Salisbury, who lived here, was a farmer and rancher. And they worked through the NPL, and they would work through other organizations in following years. But I think by the late teens, and definitely by 1920, according to Charles Taylor himself, he was clearly smitten with communism.
Now, communists don't really, at least in that period of time, in the early years of communism, didn't really take much interest in agricultural workers or farmers. They held them in contempt for the most part. So why would they pay attention to this place in northeastern Montana?
I think the higher-ups probably didn't pay too much attention at first, but again, working through the NPL and attracting the attention of that organization, and then creating a real strong base here, eventually, I think the CPUSA, I just refer to it generally as the Communist Party, began to see the potential here. And of course, without getting too bogged down in details, early on in the Communist Party history here in the United States, it was very much an urban movement. That's who the membership was. It tended to be in metropolitan areas. And exactly as you say, there was relatively little interest in the potential for revolution among farmers. But over time, the Communist International Comintern revised that position. And by that time, things were already rolling up here on the plains.
So what sort of inroads did they make in the early 20s here?
It was surprising to me in researching this just how quickly the NPL did make progress. Really quite amazing. Just after a few months of organizing in the 1918 elections, they already had success at the polls in November.
Now we should clarify something to our audience. The communists were not running as workers' party members the Communist Party went through several name changes, and we won't go into that. But they weren't running as overt communists. They didn't appear on the ballot as such in the early 20s.
That's absolutely true. And I'm not sure exactly when locals began to realize that they were dealing with communists, certainly by the mid-20s. But it's true that in the 1920 and 22 elections, they were not openly advertised or even referred to as communists. It was the Nonpartisan League, and then shortly after that, the Farmer Labor Party. It's true, though, that by the mid-20s, other newspapers, Charlie Taylor edited the Producers News, which was the Radicals newspaper, and eventually became the openly communist newspaper. Some of the competing newspapers in the area, and there were a lot of them, did by the mid-20s start to refer to the red element. But in those early elections, no, they were not acknowledging their commitments.
So take us through then how their power grew through the 1920s.
One thing I didn't know when those newspapers were discovered in my parents' old shop was that one of my ancestors actually had been involved in the early movement. My great-great-uncle, Claire Stoner, I believe was probably a socialist, and I do know that he was there at the beginning when the NPL gained a foothold here in the county. In fact, he ran for Montana House of Representatives in 1918. He was defeated at that point, and there was much controversy about how Farmer Stoner had to defeat Banker Lowe, who was his opponent. He was defeated in 1918, but in 1920, the Producers News, the Radicals newspaper, proudly proclaimed that in that election, Farmer Stoner beat Banker Lowe. So my great-great-uncle went to Helena to serve in the House. I would say, though, that the 1922 election really was the time when the movement made the greatest strides. Again, they were still associated with the Nonpartisan League. They had NPL-endorsed candidates for practically every local office, and they were just elected in a real landslides in some cases, and every single NPL-endorsed candidate was elected. So it's really not a stretch to say that the farmers' movement ran local government, especially starting in 1922. Also, I should point out that Charlie Taylor, the newspaper editor, was elected to the state Senate in the 22 election. And Uncle Claire was reelected to the House in that same election. Finally, I have to point out that Rodney Salisbury, who was, I suppose you could say, second in command to Charlie Taylor, really a dedicated activist, was elected sheriff. He had been serving as undersheriff. So the 22 election was pivotal.
Your reference to farmers and bankers suggests the economic appeal of the Communist Party, that the platform and the arguments that they put forward were essentially economic?
I think they were largely economic, and there were definitely references to, you know, sort of class stratification right from the start. Very much in terms of, you know, who was getting paid fairly and so forth, but probably also some more sort of cultural references to the lifestyle of these Main Streeters and so forth. There was a lot of powerful rhetoric being used essentially from the first issue of the Producer's News and thereafter.
And the targets were bankers, and I assume the railroads, because they're always the targets of,
yes,
of farmers. There's the dependency that they had on the railroads and the monopoly control of transportation and the setting of rates. All of those go back into the 19th century. Well, and your reference, your use of the term Main Streeters is that the newspapers used, that the Producer's News used, that referred to the bankers and all urban merchants and those, that's what it, is that correct?
That's right, the sort of mercantile class, absolutely. They would also denounce Wall Streeters. And it was interesting because I'm not certain how much the average person from this part of the state paid attention to what was going on in western Montana, but I do know that Charlie Taylor also had nothing good to say about what he referred to as the copper crowd. So there was an awareness of issues pertaining to mining and labor in western Montana.
Yeah, there was quite a socialist movement going on and communist movement going on in western Montana. Some of our listeners may be aware of that in Butte and elsewhere.
Absolutely.
In the mining district with a history of socialism and industrial workers of the world, IWW activism, yep, in that region. So there were pockets of activism in western, but what was surprising to me and to you when you discovered it is that northeastern Montana had this movement as well. So they got into power. To get back to the course of the story, they got into power, and a number of them achieved positions in government. And at this point, did everybody know that these were Reds?
I would say that the recognition was growing as the 20s proceeded, and as I said, I think the competing newspapers were happy to label some of the farmers' movement members and those who supported them as Reds. But it is also the case that the Producer's News, definitely by the mid-20s, actually embraced that label. And they would advertise Red revels, celebrations, dances for farmers' movement members. And moreover, starting in the latter half of the 20s, the Producer's News would run sort of syndicated columns by members of the Communist Party USA, people like Claude Pepper, and, you know, just pretty clearly addressing issues of class and Leninism, and using the kinds of terms that I think anybody would recognize as being openly ideological.
We should also point out that in the adjacent county in North Dakota, there was also a communist who was elected to the North Dakota legislature in 1924, I believe it was.
That's right.
So that suggests something that it went a little bit beyond the boundaries of the county, this movement.
It's true. And even across the line in Daniels County, which is the next county to the west, there was some radicalism. And that was fought tooth and nail by another important player whose name was Burley Bowler, also a newspaper editor. and someone who's starting right at the beginning in 1918 had made himself a kind of critic of Charlie Taylor and his ilk.
You know, over the years, there have been a number of oral histories that have been conducted here in the region with some of the folks who were alive then or whose parents were active. I know that back in the 1980s, Laurie Mercier and Rex Myers, I believe it was, and Jackie Day conducted a series of interviews. And we have those recordings, and I think we should play a few selections from them just so we'll get the sense of what people thought about that era. So we'll play a few of those, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Oh, this was a county that was known for its red activity. Mm-hmm. Kearns County was kind of the center of it at one time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that, what they call her, Ma, something come up here.
Oh, yeah, Mother Blar?
Yeah, Mother Blar, something like that, yeah. I remember. Yeah. That Producer's News, that was a...
Communist paper, really.
Strictly a communist paper. Mm-hmm. And they had some... That Charlie Taylor was the editor on, he was sharp as a tack. Great. One time they had a communist party where they sang the song.
People run to the communist way, scarlet banner triumphantly for communism and for liberty. They'd say, we didn't know what was going on even. And they had roller skating, free roller skating, so we...
That was down at the communist temple?
Yeah, right down at the communist harbor labor temple. I guess they must have rented it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One, two, three, young communists, four, five, six, we're happy Bolsheviks.
Yeah, and I'd sing, we'd sing
with just a bunch of kids together. We didn't know what the hell they were doing.
We'd pick up all the kids and say, we just go in and know we get free roller skating.
Like the Pied Piper.
Yeah, right.
I never went to a meeting, but I heard the song.
Of course, we knew it was terrible because they were anti-religious, weren't they? We didn't dare tell our folks that we had anything to do, but we just go roller skating and stuff, you know.
Yeah. How did the song go again?
Wave scarlet banner triumphantly for communism and for liberty.
One, two, three.
Communists are we.
Four, five, six, we're happy Bolsheviks.
Yeah.
I just said it was sorry, but I...
Yeah, yeah. And it's thing. Yeah. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. Then they had a big parade, and all the farmers seemed to be in the parade. We never dare go.
But this Charlie was a very brilliant man. He was in the legislature, but he turned kind of red or communist, which we were probably about the second most communistic deal there was in the state. I believe Bainville, Montana was probably the number one.
Oh, wow.
And we were probably number two. And they were real, real red. They were willing to sell out the country.
Uh-huh.
And this Charlie Taylor, that he was a writer for the Producer's News, and good mind, it's too bad that he wasn't on the right side of the fence. And then, of course, the Plentywood Herald, they had a fellow by the name of L.S. Olson that was the editor of the Plentywood Herald at the time. And oh, how they would ridicule one another. And L.S. Olson was kind of a large, rotunder man. And Charlie Taylor was the way that they could write those days. He wrote a little article that said that L.S. Olson, when he walked down the street, he sounded like a bag of guts getting kicked out. So you were able to express yourself, and of course, no lawsuits those days. Well, what would you sue? Nobody had any money. But he was had a fabulous and a good, sharp mind on him, this Charlie Taylor. I talked to him several times down at his house when I was a kid. I'd be down there playing with his boy, and he would tell me all of the derogatory things of all of the senators, Wheeler and all of them, and Ayers and some of the old past governors and that, and... Yeah, he always had something that on him or something that just wasn't cricket with the way the world was going today.
The worker's flag is deepest red. It flies above our martyred dead and blah, 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 blah. And it's like my mother said, you have to eat every day. And she took a great deal of pride in being red. Are you red? We're reds. Do you believe in God in your house? These were questions to be asked on the school grounds. Are you reds in your house? Yeah, I'm a red. Do you believe in God in your house? No, we don't believe in God in our house. I still don't believe in God, and I'm still kind of a red. Sure as hell pinko, anyway.
Everybody was concerned with each other, and you know... We really prided ourselves on our co-ops here, the co-op grocery store. We had a cooperative burial association, a man that made caskets just as good as any you could buy. Our coal mine was a cooperative. Our fire insurance, and that's still a very going concern. Farmers Mutual, but it's, and they all started in the Dagmar area because they had experience from Denmark in those fields. And then we had our own, they had their own flour mill in Antelope. You laid in provisions, you know, you'd take your wheat to the mill and you'd get flour and you'd have, oh, you brought your coal from the Coolidge coal mine too and had the basement floor, coal shed.
I think it's great to have these firsthand accounts of events so far away from us in time.
One of the surprising things for me as I began to learn about this period was how early farmers were desperate in Sheridan County and that region. That is, I think most people think about the Dirty 30s as the time of desperation. But in fact, it was hard to farm on the prairies of northeastern Montana right from the start. There would be crop failures due to drought or army worms or grasshoppers. There were sometimes prairie fires. All kinds of things were going wrong. And I think that the average farmer just didn't feel that there was any safety net or even any attention being paid by the sort of Wall Streeters and the Main Streeters and those in power. So that's one appeal. And of course, since my area of training academically is in communication, I think that the radicals also just did a really effective job of appealing to and persuading the farmers that if they could be elected to office, they would bring about change. And for instance, as time went on, there would be sometimes interference with sheriff sales. That is, if the sheriff came to liquidate or repossess equipment that a farmer wasn't able to make payments on, sometimes the radicals would actually interfere with that auction or sale. And there were other ways in which they were actively involved in addressing some of the needs of the farmers and workers that did have great appeal.
Now, one of my interests in this whole story is the whole intersection of culture and politics. And I think I want to go a little bit further into the appeal and note the fact that some towns gave a lot more support to the communists than others. And that interested me. And areas like Dagmar, and maybe you could talk about that, or we can talk about that together.
Sure. Well, you know that places like Dagmar and Outlook, for example, which is near where I grew up, had high density of Scandinavian first or second generation immigrants. And so, of course, just in terms of where they had lived, there was a greater degree of comfort with socialism and sort of the cooperative-minded spirit. So there was that. Additionally, in places like Raymond, Outlook, and so forth, there absolutely was a sense of more of a rural community as opposed to the somewhat more metropolitan, if you can count a town of 800 or 900 people as being so very urban. There was a real sense, I think, of the difference between those in the country and those in the city. And the farmers' movement had great appeal for them. And, of course, pitting the Main Streeters against those who produced, who worked for a living and labored. And the radicals made the most of that. I would also say that a lot of folks in northeastern Montana were religious. And the radicals made good use of that kind of rhetoric and would sometimes, you know, even make reference to figures from the Bible. For instance, just an example would be referring to one of the opponents of the farm movement as a Pharisee. So they used a kind of language that was familiar. The newspaper was very entertaining and found ways to reach people where they lived, so to speak.
you know, we should, before we go forward, we should point out, we should have done this earlier, but we should point out that the whole county had a population of maybe about 13, 14,000 in the 20s and early 30s or so, the period we're talking about.
It's true that the population was never dense, but even so, I think there was always a sense of who was from the country and who was from the so-called city, the haves and the have-nots.
All right, we were talking about the appeal. Now, what happened to that appeal through the 20s that led to the defeat in 1928?
I think a number of things happened. One, of course, was that some of the rhetoric of the farmers' movement did become more militant and more doctrinaire. But that actually escalated even after the 28 election. I think there were a number of things. There were a few good harvests there in the 1920s. Also, the radicals became sort of the insiders. Once they were running county government, they really were, I think, perceived as kind of the old gang themselves. Additionally, there were some other issues that began to emerge as the 20s went on. One was that Sheriff Salisbury was suspected and sometimes even accused in the competing press of doing things like either tolerating or maybe participating in bootlegging, of sort of favoritism, maybe not making his own friends pay for their automobile licenses. There was a significant heist in 1926. That is when the county treasury was robbed by masked gunmen of about $105,000 in cash and bonds. This case was never solved, and there were accusations for years that the radicals had somehow been involved, possibly that Sheriff Salisbury just simply hadn't investigated as thoroughly as he should have. Others said perhaps he or others were involved. Things like that began to accumulate, and by the 1928 election, the radicals were defeated, I think to a great degree to their surprise.
I wonder, too, if some of the personal issues, the complicated relationship that the sheriff had with another activist in the party, Marie Hansen, may have had an impact.
It is true that the sheriff essentially started a second family with Marie, who had also been involved in the movement. But I think there were other issues, too. For instance, the competing press at one point divulged that Charles Taylor had had a first family and suggested that he had abandoned them. And I think that there did come to be some concerns in the community about some of the personal choices being made by the farmers' movement leaders.
A lot of people that were interviewed, that I interviewed and other folks interviewed, that you interviewed and that the folks in the 1980s interviewed, recall the turning point as Janice Salisbury's funeral. Just recently, in going through the county myself and talking to people, I must have had at least 10 or 11 of them who said that the movement would have continued if it hadn't been for what took place at that funeral. So let's talk a little bit about that funeral and why they might think it was a turning point, even though we know that the Communist Party was defeated several years before the funeral.
Pretty soundly defeated. I view that funeral as possibly the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think that it has become in popular memory, as you said, the turning point. The funeral occurred in 1932. Janice Salisbury was the teenage daughter, one of a set of twins, of Rodney Salisbury, who had been the very controversial communist sheriff in Sheridan County. Janice died of appendicitis. And she was memorialized not in a church, but rather in the Farmer Labor Temple that had been built. It was a community effort, but it was absolutely spearheaded by the radicals after the 1924 election, which had been very successful. And the Producers News referred to the Farmer Labor Temple as a kind of monument to the triumph of the party. So this large building was decorated with hammers and sickles and red bunting, and the young communist organization members said their pledge. The Internationale was sung, and it was a service that was absolutely not religious. It was, in fact, described as a Bolshevist funeral for a young girl. And the funeral certainly was significant. But as you already mentioned, in 1928, the radicals had been soundly defeated at the polls. And that likewise had been the case in the local elections in 1930. So it really was, in many respects, over for them long before the funeral.
Actually, I in talking about the funeral, I jumped forward, but it's because I did want to bring up the whole issue of memory and how memory works in oral history, and how people many years removed from the event sometimes conflate events or associate a decline or associate one thing with another. But that reveals something about where their minds are at and how oral tradition is created and how folklore is created. I want to continue the discussion of the decline of the Reds, but I think since we raised the funeral, I want to play two recollections of the funeral by two individuals who actually were there. So we're gonna listen to some more oral history and then go back to the years before the funeral and try to explain why they were soundly why the communists were really soundly defeated, and then we'll move forward. So let's listen to some firsthand accounts of the funeral of Janice Salisbury.
Janice Salisbury was the daughter of the who had been the sheriff, and evidently she died from, I think, pneumonia or possibly some natural cause. But they had this communist funeral, and we didn't get inside, but we watched them bring in the casket. It was draped over the communist flag, and it was carried by what they understood, or what we understood, was called the Red Guard. Others call them the Young Pioneers. Now, take your choice. But they come. We were standing outside, and they come by us and into the auditorium. We're there, and I talked to some of the people later that were inside, and they said there was nothing mentioned religious. The big people in charge there, what they talked about was the advantages of the Communist Party, and that was all they said. That was all they told me, anyways. But it was quite a deal. I understand that that's what kind of turned the county against the communist, was that funeral, what I understand.
And when Janice died, there was devastation. Everybody was sad, and everybody seemed to be running around and very active. I was pretty well ignored, but that's all right. At the day of the funeral, was a day of great activity, and I can't remember what everybody was up to, but everybody seemed to be up to a lot, running around all over the place. There was a lot of discussion, and I remember specifically how concerned they were that they not be involved with any preachers. These people were all atheists. We were all atheists. The funeral is held in the Farmers' Labor Temple. Now, the Farmers' Labor Temple was like an auditorium. It looked not unlike the Grange Halls that are all over the place. It had a wooden floor. It had windows on the walls with benches around the periphery. It had a small stage, and the ceiling was wood. It was not a terribly ornate building. It had no ornaments whatsoever, as a matter of fact. But being a farm labor temple, it was had one decoration, and that was the hammer and sickle, which of course represented farmers and laborers. And as far as the socialists of those days, these are the people that created the wealth, and they were the most important people. The funeral was in the afternoon, if I remember correctly,
and we were all sitting there in chairs, and there were speakers on that small stage. There were many, many speakers. Most of them seemed to me to be men. I don't remember the speeches necessarily, but they were talking about the world that Janet lived in and how profound her death was to her family, to her father and mother, of course. But it reminded me today, when I look back on it, as the celebration of the lives of people that we do quite often. But I know that it was almost an anti-Christian funeral, and they wanted it so. They didn't want any preachers around the place, and there were none. And I know that an awful lot of people were talking about that and said that was a terrible thing to do. But it seemed to me, my little adolescent mind, that they could do what they wanted to do with their daughter.
It goes along with why people remember the funeral. An irreligious event reminds people that perhaps communists are all atheists, and that's not the culture that they want to be part of.
That's right. It made it harder for the radicals to continue to claim that they weren't anti-religious. It was surprising to me to learn that as early as 1918, the first year that the Producers News was being published, that Charlie Taylor had published a column. I think the headline was God and the Selection Campaign. And he essentially argued that just because the farmers' movement wanted change, it didn't mean that they were against God. And that refrain was sounded over and over in the subsequent years. But I think the funeral made it pretty clear, at least to some people, where they stood.
You know, I was just thinking, we've been talking a lot about local affairs, and yet the movement had a national and international context that really impacted the local or communists and the local organizations. Let's move into that dimension of the story and then get back to the local afterwards.
It's an important point to make that in 1928, Comintern, the Communist International, proclaimed the third period of communism. And essentially, it was that the view that capitalism was in decline, that the end was near, and that communist organizations worldwide needed to proudly proclaim their ideology. What that meant at the local level in Sheridan County, well, it actually was a number of things, one of which was that the organization would become aligned with the United Farmers League, which was the agrarian branch of the Communist Party in the USA. What it meant in terms of their organizing and their means of persuasion was that the newspaper would become a lot less chatty, I suppose you could say more doctrinaire than it had been. It also meant that Charlie Taylor was sent off to do organizing work elsewhere. And a party bureaucrat, I suppose you could say, whose specialty was journalism, was sent from New York City to edit the Producers News. Finally, just one important point is that in 1931, the Producers News was selected to be the party's farm paper, and it was picked up for distribution nationwide, which was a significant change. You know, instead of just the small county that we've talked about, now it was distributed across the country.
You know, one of the former editors of the Producers News, Rob Hall, who came in after Charlie Taylor and after Eric Burt, the fellow who was sent in from New York to edit the paper. And he recalled some of these events, but he was only there for about a month or so. But he's an example of what the party, how much attention the party was paying to this newspaper at the time, that they were sending these folks in. And all of them, I found, were trained by Rex Tugwell in Columbia. Both Eric Burt and Rob Hall were students of Rex Tugwell. They were left-wing students, and Rex Tugwell, who was involved with the New Deal and FDR, didn't really agree with their politics, but nonetheless, there is still correspondence between the two of them. That connection, they all were specialists in agricultural economics.
That's right. And, you know, they were dedicated, knowledgeable, educated, as you said, people. I'm not sure that always served them well in appealing to the locals. You know, one of the things that Charlie Taylor did really well was he was earthy. He, you know, really identified with the farmers. And, of course, I should say that a person like Eric Burt, he really did have to toe the line in terms of what he published. For example, I mentioned the third period sort of edicts about how to organize and persuade. Eric Burt had to adhere to the doctrine of the day. And so the newspaper was being distributed widely, but I don't think it was as readable for locals anymore.
Now, Eric came in with his wife, and his wife was really was in charge of this summer camp, or this young pioneer camp in Brush Lake, which we should say a little bit about. Brush Lake is a local resort area where a lot of camps were held, a lot of picnics with different organizations. And young pioneers and the attempt in 31, 32, I guess.
Yes.
To reach out to young people and to train them in Marxism. I mean, that also probably alienated the community considerably.
You're absolutely right. And I know that you have written about a trial that occurred that probably had a lot to do with the community's concern about young people being indoctrinated, those from here in this part of the state, and even some young people being sent over from North Dakota for these camps and schools. And it's true, Ruth Burt headed those up, and they were, you know, clearly intentional at training the next generation of revolutionaries.
And that divided the community even more.
I believe it did.
Yeah. So they're doing all of these things, and what happens next after 32? After
the 32 election really just confirmed what had happened in 28, and that was disappointment at the polls. One important thing that I should point out about the 32 election is that Sheridan County still, it did have a real strong radical element, and there were still many votes cast even for local communist candidates who were, as I just said, on the ballot as communists. You know, one candidate in particular, a candidate for county commissioner who was a communist, received 1,100 votes, but he was still defeated by a Republican. One thing I wanted to say was that the communist candidate for governor of Montana received, I have to double check now, 25% of the vote in Sheridan County. That sounds still rather impressive until one finds out that that was Rodney Salisbury, who had been the sheriff. And one would hope that favorite son would get even more than 25% of the vote. I suppose to sum up, though, as I said before, 1932 was a huge disappointment for the radicals, and it was clear that their heyday absolutely was over.
Now, Rob Hall, who is no longer alive, recalled Rodney Salisbury coming in to the Producers News to attack another fellow who was working at the Producers News, Hans Rasmussen, and Rob picking up a lead pipe to defend him. And behind that attack was the fact that no longer was the left united in the county. Rodney Salisbury had left the party, and the paper was now in the hands of the party. Apparently, there was a large division between Trotskyists and Stalinists in the community. And that, I know that complicates the picture, but I think we should bring it in and talk a little bit about that.
I think it was probably confusing for the average person, too. You say it complicates it for the listener. I think it complicated it for the folks in the community who had already seen the farmers' movement switch its name three times, from the NPL to the Farmer Labor Party to the UFL. And now to see some of these former comrades going after each other with lead pipes. Rodney, some of his colleagues were expelled because of their position. Charlie Taylor, who had been just, you know, absolutely thick as thieves with Rodney, was now denouncing him in the pages of the Producer's News. That sort of thing happened frequently in the history of the Communist Party in the United States, but I think to many folks it just looked inexplicable and disloyal.
Ironically, both Charlie Taylor and Rodney left the party and were expelled and readmitted. Well, Charlie was readmitted and then expelled again.
Oh, and chose to quit paying his dues finally. Finally, right. he had it. Yeah. Yes.
And he was a Trotskyist.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So it was just a period of a lot of consternation, both for those who were the true believers. And I think for those who were desperate, even more so as the 30s went on, and looking for solutions. And of course, before too long, FDR, and then in the run-up to World War II, the situation did begin to improve for farmers. And at least for many, then it became clear that they really didn't need communism as much as they might have thought 10 years before they did.
And yet, there is still a sort of a collectivist ethos here. There's a number of cooperatives. There's an electrical cooperative, a telephone cooperative here. There are elements of that mentality, not communism, not Stalinism, but still a belief that farmers needed to work together in a collective way to better their lives.
I think that you're absolutely right. And in fact, I was just chatting with a gentleman yesterday over in Daniels County who used to work for the telephone cooperative, and he was saying that he wondered if some of that cooperative spirit was evaporating, that a more corporate model was, I hate to say, invading the region. I think that there's a lot of nostalgia and still, as you said, a lot of admiration for the kind of cooperative spirit that did animate people in this region, and maybe still does.
So it spread well beyond the Dagmar community and their and the Scandinavian co-ops.
It absolutely did.
Yeah. So what happened to the principal players in this drama? What became of them in the decades afterwards?
Right. Some stayed, some scattered. Charlie Taylor packed up his printing press. The last edition of his Producer's News was in the spring of 1937. He moved out to Seattle with his family and had his own press for a while, did some editing at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. He stayed involved in politics, but not the Communist Party. Rodney Salisbury and his common-law wife, Marie, moved out to western Montana. Rodney came back to Plentywood for a visit in 1938. So, you know, really very close to the time in which he had been the sheriff. And he died, according to his death certificate, of a brain hemorrhage. But of course, you know, there was still much talk about whether it might have actually been the result of a barroom fight. And he just attracted a lot of attention for the span of his life in the county. Another person who I haven't mentioned before and who never ran for office was Johnny Boltz. And Johnny stayed involved in the Socialist Workers Party until 1948 and even helped bring some well-known SWP spokespersons and candidates to Plentywood, Montana to give speeches. So the different actors generally went their separate ways, but I think for many years, especially during the Cold War, we really did retain a reputation as that red corner up there.
Fascinating story. And I hope that listeners have an opportunity to read more about it in your book, The Red Corner, The Rise and Fall of Communism in Northeastern Montana. Thank you so much for joining us here on Talking History.
Thanks so much for having me, Jerry.
The previous interview was recorded in Plentywood, Montana. We thank the Montana Historical Society and Humanities Montana for their generous support of this project.